It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday, the number of coronavirus deaths in the U.S. crossed 300,000. Also yesterday, our country, the world's hardest hit nation, rolled out its first vaccine inoculations. Here in Iowa, as in other states, frontline healthcare workers were the first to receive the first dose of a two-dose Pfizer vaccine. Iowa officials expect to receive 172,000 doses of COVID-19 vaccines by the end of this month. And just today, we heard news that it's likely a second vaccine. This is the one from Moderna, will be approved by the FDA for emergency use probably sometime this week. Let's start this hour by checking in once again with Dr. Stanley Perlman, an immunologist, microbiologist, researcher at the University of Iowa, a recognized world authority on coronaviruses. Dr. Perlman, thank you for joining us again.
My pleasure.
You sit on an FDA committee that evaluates the COVID vaccines, and as such, part of a national team of scientists who have helped make this medical feat possible. I believe congratulations are in order. How do you feel?
Well, I'm really ecstatic that we have a vaccine that seems to be effective and safe, and will perhaps will help us eliminate this pandemic, which is, as you pointed out, killing 1 in 1,000 people so far in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Have you been inoculated yet?
No, I don't fall in the right categories to be inoculated. The people who are inoculated are people who are our frontline healthcare workers. This just started in the last day or two, and these are the people who see patients or work in the hospital in auxiliary roles. They are the people who need to be vaccinated before me.
Yeah. You must be interested in the very early feedback. Are you getting any of that?
No, I'm not getting early feedback. I reviewed all the literature that Pfizer put out, as well as the FDA's comments on that literature. So I know a lot about what's expected, and so far I haven't heard anything that's unexpected. And especially after the first dose, we don't expect there to be too much reaction. Some people still get sore arms, but it's more common after the second inoculation.
Okay, let's talk about those who get inoculated. And increasingly, more and more Iowans, more and more Americans will be inoculated. Walk us through quickly how soon an inoculated person becomes fully immunized.
Well, there's actually really even good news on this front. So people need two immunizations to be fully protected. But we know from the initial Pfizer studies that even the first one is protective after a few days. So it takes a little while for the body to mount an antibody response and a T-cell response. But we know that even before they receive the second shot, people are protected from developing COVID-19. So I think the number we use is maybe 14 days, but it may even be less than that for starting to have some response that's protective.
And in our last conversation, you said the stronger your immune system reacts, sort of almost like the worse you feel, the better in this case, right?
Yeah, that's what we think. No one's done that rigorously, but that's our thinking.
Mm-hmm. How long, once we have antibodies built up, a person is, are you completely bulletproof with sufficient antibodies, so to speak?
No, one shouldn't think like that because we have to still be cautious. We don't know if this vaccine prevents transmission. So a person can still get infected, be perfectly fine, but still have virus in their nose and mouth that can spread it to other people. So you definitely don't have a bullet. Maybe for yourself you do for some amount of time. We don't know how long the immunity lasts. But even if vaccination is perfect, we still have to be cautious until many people are vaccinated, so we reach somewhere around 70% or so of the U.S. population being immunized against the virus.
Okay, so the picture that we shouldn't have, and in some months' time, is people walking around unmasked and saying, "Don't worry, I'm no threat to you." That's not going to happen in the near future.
Yeah, that's right. So we don't want to do that. It may be that you yourself are more protected against disease. But we so far no evidence, and we hope there will be evidence, that transmission is prevented. But we just don't know that yet. And that, of course, is a key part of getting out of this pandemic mess.
Mm-hmm. What is the difference in layman's terms, if you could, between the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines?
Oh.
Is that easy to explain? Probably not.
It's pretty small differences. They're both mRNA vaccines. One of them is formulated, or it's put together a little differently, so it's more stable. They both require very cold temperatures to arrive at a site, but the Pfizer vaccine's only useful in the refrigerator for a few hours, while the Moderna vaccine is useful in the refrigerator, I believe, for 2 weeks, if I understand it correctly. But in terms of a person receiving the vaccines, so far I don't know of any major differences.
Mm-hmm. From your vantage point, is it likely most Americans will be inoculated with one of these two vaccines, should Moderna be approved for use later in the week, or will there be possibly others coming online too?
Well, we know others are coming on. We know there's at least three others that are being considered, one from AstraZeneca, one from Johnson & Johnson, and one from Novavax. And they're all a little different, and they're behind the RNA vaccines in terms of phase 1, 2, 3 trials and approval by the FDA. I would bet that we will be having approval of most of them by February, maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe February, March, maybe earlier. Maybe February is a good guess. And then several vaccines will be available. Although those three vaccines don't require the same kind of cold chain that the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines have. And the cold chain matters, if not for a huge hospital like the University of Iowa's hospital. University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics. But when you one goes out to rural communities or places that have smaller hospitals, maintaining the cold chain may be a challenge.
Mm-hmm. The federal government rushing to roll out a $250 million public education campaign to encourage Americans to take the vaccine. Public support is split. One poll, 60% of people say they were likely to get the shot. A Pew poll found 20% strongly opposed. What are your expectations for how confidence in these approved vaccines will change in the coming months?
Well, I think they're already changing for the better, because even a month ago, I don't think the worst result would have been 60% approval. I think we were lower than that.
Yes.
So I think as people are hearing about safety and that they work, there's going to be less vaccine hesitancy. Because of the way things are, there's always going to be a fraction of people in this country who are nervous about vaccines to the point of never taking them and having for various reasons for not doing so. So I don't think we'll win those people over. But if we get up to 70% vaccination, then that's sort of where we want to be. The higher the better, because the higher it is, the less likely we are to have the virus in the community at all.
Mm-hmm. And then this pandemic is just crushed if we reach that level.
I hate using the word crushed, just because it's very positive and it's certainly what we aim for, but we have to see exactly how transmission plays out here. But mm-hmm. Yes, I would hope that it's crushed. You know, you could go back to another disease. Measles vaccination is complete, but would you call it crushed when we still have a few hundred cases in the U.S. per year and outbreaks in California? It's just how you want to use the words.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what about those who've had COVID and recovered? How does their immunity compare with those who receive one of these vaccines?
That's a really good question, because we know some of those people get reinfected. Not very common, but some of them do. And we don't know how long their immunity is durable either, just like we don't after the vaccination. So these are all things that time will tell, and is really important for us to figure out. But if it's similar to other coronavirus infections, there's a good chance, even if you have a mild one, that you'll have immunity for a year, maybe less than a year. If you have a more severe infection, much longer. The vaccination, the numbers that people are seeing after vaccination are very similar to severe disease. So there's a good chance that the vaccine will have longer lasting immunity than the natural infection. But for very, very mild natural infection, I don't know how long that's going to last, because our evidence from the cold virus says generally about a year, could be a little less, could be more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dr. Perlman, what are you watching most of all right now in these first days and coming weeks of this campaign of inoculations?
Well, the thing I'm most interested in and most worrying about would be just to make sure that the good safety profile that we've seen in the 40,000 or so people who have received these vaccines, and maybe 80,000 if we include Moderna, that that's borne out as we go into millions of people being vaccinated. Mm-hmm. And of course, I want it to be efficacious as well. But safety is the most important thing that will make people be very eager to receive the vaccine.
You mentioned in an earlier conversation, you've granted us, fortunately, a series of conversations that you'd literally not had a day off since back in March, the beginning of this pandemic. How does your work change now that we have likely to have, perhaps this week, two vaccines that are up for use?
I hope that because we have vaccines, and if the pandemic starts receding, I hope that my life, that the research that we're doing on coronaviruses continues as it's doing, but everything is less urgent. So there's not the same kind of need to do everything yesterday.
Mm, very good. We'll let you get back to it. Very busy man. Thank you for joining us on this historic week. And again, congratulations as one of our top scientists on board with this historic medical breakthrough. Dr. Stanley Perelman of the University of Iowa, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we are in the midst of one of the deadliest events modern Americans have ever grappled with. On several recent days, more Americans died from COVID-19 than were killed in the attack on 9/11. On several recent days, single days, more Americans died from COVID-19 during the attack on Pearl Harbor. And since the start of this pandemic, more Americans have died from COVID-19 than U.S. battle deaths in all of World War II. Think about that. More Americans have died from this pandemic in these past 9 months or so than the number of U.S. soldiers killed in the bloodiest war in human history. And yet many of us are not behaving much differently. Somehow it's not really sinking in. Why? Well, perhaps part of that reason is how this health crisis is being communicated. My next guest has researched how narratives and storytelling can be used to communicate science with non-expert audiences. Michael Dahlstrom is the LAS Dean's Professor and Director of the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've researched something called scientific storytelling. Before we get into your thoughts on the current times, what is scientific storytelling?
You bet. Well, if you think about it, there's lots of different ways that you can communicate about science. You can use more of an expository format where I just tell you what's going on. We know that this is true. There can be an argumentative format, which is where I try and convince you using evidence and claims. We know this, therefore we know this, therefore this is true. What I'm very interested in is another format, which is a narrative format, where instead of telling you why you should believe it or what we know, I give you the experience of a person who has experienced that science at the scale of human direct experience. And it's very different. It's the idea of saying, rather than here's why you should believe it, it's here's a story of this individual person and here's what happened to them.
Mm-hmm. And so broadly speaking, what have you researched here? Tell us what you found out about scientific storytelling.
Well, so what we find out is that when science is packaged into stories, it carries a greater weight on decision-making, on perspectives. And one of the reasons is because stories are the default mode of human thought. A lot of times I say stories are the native language of humanity. It's how we experience the world. We experience it in these cases. This happened to me yesterday. This happened to me today. I heard this story about what happened to this person last week. And so those cases are stored in our mind, and that's how we make sense of the world. Mm-hmm. So when people communicate science or any topic, if it's packaged in a story, it's already in the same format in how we think. And so it's much easier to process, and therefore it carries greater weight in our decision making.
And for your research, I believe you looked at public perceptions of measles. What time did you focus on, and what did you do there?
So actually, it wasn't measles, it was the HPV vaccine. But even more broadly, I've looked at this phenomenon across a lot of different scientific topics. So we've looked at climate change, we've looked at vaccines, we've looked at health topics in general, some agricultural issues. And while each of these scientific topics are different in their own regards, we still see that the stories, because again, it's at the scale of human experience, they carry greater weight. And I think this current topic is just perfect, because vaccines, just as a topic, show this in very stark difference, because we've got science, which comes out and says, we have these abstract truths. We've studied tens of thousands of people. And if we look across all of that, we know what vaccines can do. We know the risks are small, et cetera. But when a person gets a vaccine, it's not about the 10,000s of tests. It's about that person's experience. And so we see this conflict where we have often one side talking with abstract scientific truths, which are completely accurate. And we have people talking with their single anecdotal direct experience, which can also be completely accurate. And that's where things get tricky.
Right. And I assume some people are more open to scientific reasoning, data, while others are more open to being convinced by a narrative.
Absolutely. So we have a range of deference to science across people, and that can be brought on by, you know, their experience with science, if they've had good experiences, if they maybe have training in science. But I do want to emphasize that even so, the stories are still how we think. So I usually say we're born with the ability to understand and tell stories. Mm-hmm. Science and logical thinking takes a lot of training, which is why we have school, which is why we have spent all these years training people to think in these scientific, rational ways. And it's the best way we know how to understand the world, because it lets us see these broader patterns. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, when we relax, even people who are scientists who have trained for decades, we slip back into experiencing the world one case at a time. And that's often how we talk to our friends, our spouse, our children. We don't say, hey, here's a general truth. Or if we do, we more often say, but let me tell you what happened to me yesterday. This is a good story.
Right, right. And those who are trained in science, some degree of science, will hear one case study, one story of one person, and immediately, at least I think, a red flag goes up and says, okay, but what? That's one person. You can find a story about one person to demonstrate pretty much anything happening in the world. But some degree of science training tells you it's not about one person, it's about the larger data.
Exactly. It adds that level of scrutiny to say, oh, okay, that could be true, but maybe it's an outlier. So let me seek out more information.
Okay. So in order for us to be rid of this pandemic, it's critical that we develop herd immunity through immunization. How do you think scientific storytelling should be used now from this point forward to communicate what's at stake to encourage immunization among skeptics?
I think we are at a very important inflection point right now, because there's been a lot of talk about the virus, the vaccine leading up to this week. So there's lots of hopes that this will help us return to a normal life. So there's been a lot of talk, but I believe it was yesterday when the first shots were being given. So now I think what we're going to hear is beyond hope and discussion of why it's safe, we're going to start hearing personal stories. And stories can be representative or they can be outliers. And often it is the outlier stories that are more dramatic. And so often those are the ones that carry farther, that are told more often. And so I think what needs to happen, the science is there. The science has been there. That's not going to change. But I think communicators who want to tell about that science and health professionals that want to communicate the importance of vaccines, they cannot stop at just the science, because that's not showing how the science intersects with human experience. Other people will start telling those stories, and you know, many of them will be positive, some of them may be negative. But the science communicators also need to realize that they have the power to tell those stories, and they're very accurate stories. You could tell a story about a family who questioned whether or not they wanted to get the vaccine, and they decided to get the vaccine, and they felt better about it afterwards. Mm-hmm. That could be an example of a very accurate story, but it still, it shows the science at where it intersects with human experience, which is where it impacts people's decision-making.
Fascinating, Michael. I wonder, before we say goodbye, a brief aside into something not related to this pandemic. I wonder if your area of research, and it seems by what you said that it may, has anything to say about our election aftermath. You mentioned climate change, people's belief or non-belief in it. On the one hand, in terms of our election aftermath, the science, the data is clear. Donald Trump clearly lost this election, both in terms of the popular vote and in terms of the Electoral College. And yet tens of millions of Americans choose not to believe what I'll just say is the science of counting, certifying votes, instead believe the story propagated by Donald Trump and his allies that the election was stolen. So this is the same thing you're talking about.
So what I'm talking about, I would say, is true across almost any topic, because you're just differentiating abstract from concrete experience. This case about the election, I think, gets even messier, because as soon as you wrap in politics, you roll in identity. Now, all of a sudden, it's not just story versus abstraction, but now there's a personal, there's an identity. I want to be a certain person. And so now there's even more risk for me to reject certain narratives or accept them, because it's not just about truth. It's about who I see myself to be. And science can get there too. Climate change has waded into this territory. But anytime we roll in personal identity, oh man, it gets so much trickier.
Okay. We'll save that for another time. Michael, I hope to talk to you again in the near future. Michael Dahlstrom is the LAS Dean's Professor, Director of the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University, sharing his research and its implications for today, research on scientific storytelling. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Coming up after a short break, we'll look at how the COVID vaccines just developed compare with top medical breakthroughs of the last century. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, coming to you on this historic week at the start of a national campaign of mass inoculations to end this pandemic. Well, the speed at which the COVID-19 vaccines have been developed is unprecedented in the history of medicine. Vaccines like polio, tuberculosis took decades to develop. Some of our older listeners will remember the celebration of the polio vaccine in the 1950s. But let's talk about how this current medical feat compares with other medical breakthroughs in the past 100 years or so with a medical historian. Sue Lederer is with us. She's the Robert Turrell Professor of History of Medicine and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin at Madison's School of Medicine and Public Health. Sue Lederer, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much. This is a historic day.
Isn't it? Before we delve into the past, I'm glad you started right with that reaction, because before we get into this history that that you know so much about, what are your thoughts as this unprecedented vaccination campaign gets underway?
Well, I should be honest and upfront and say I was a skeptic that this could be accomplished in the time frame that it has, but it is truly extraordinary. And as you said, I think in the opening, unprecedented in the history of medicine. I can't think of any other thing like this, the speed with which we have an effective preventive for such a disease that has been, you know, ravaging our country and countries around the world.
Mm-hmm. let's go back to the first vaccines. When was the very first vaccine created? Can you pinpoint that as a historian?
Actually, you know, it's one of the times in the history of medicine when you have a really firm date. 1796, so it's more than 100 years back. Mm-hmm. But an English physician named Edward Jenner was interested, in protecting children, including his own children, against the terrible scourge of smallpox, which is a disease that not only had a high, fatality rate, but if you survived, you might be terribly scarred and disfigured, perhaps blind, if you developed smallpox in your eyes. And in 1796, Jenner used material from infected cows, infected with cowpox, to vaccinate an 8-year-old boy, the son of his gardener. And he was doing so based on sort of the news in his area that dairy maids, young women who milked cows and developed cowpox, seemed to be immune to smallpox. Hmm. So it was his, thought that if he took cowpox and gave it to this young boy, he would be protected from smallpox, which would be a tremendous thing. Now, one of the things that I find really fascinating about that is not only did he, try to prevent him from getting smallpox, but in order to establish that the vaccination was effective, he actually took pus from somebody with active human smallpox and implanted it in the arm of James Phipps.
Wow.
Unfortunately for all, James did not develop smallpox. But, that kind of challenge experiment was absolutely essential to know that what you were doing was actually effective in protecting you against, the more dreaded disease mm-hmm. from which you were trying to protect people.
Back at that time, I just wanted to say how much did they understand of what was going on in the body when they did that or in this initial vaccination?
They had an understanding of the body, which is very different from our own today understanding of the body. They had no insight into, viruses or bacteria. This is 100 years almost 100 years before the germ theory of disease. So they were really flying blind. It was based on experience. Milkmaids don't get smallpox because they mm-hmm. get cowpox. So it was a very much, something that they had observed that they were acting on. Mm-hmm. And they had really no understanding of immunity per se, except that they knew that if you developed smallpox and survived, you never got smallpox again. And that was important to know.
Right. Let's go to a vaccine that is in the living memory of many who have who are listening right now, polio, the polio vaccine.
Right.
In the 1950s. Tell us a bit of that story.
All right. Well, polio is an interesting infectious disease because unlike other infectious diseases, which seem to get much less infectious, like tuberculosis declined in the 20th century, polio actually became more and more feared over the course of the mid-20th century. And in fact, the worst epidemic year for polio was 1952, when thousands of children needed iron lungs to sustain them from the paralysis brought on by polio. And ever since at least 1916, there had been a search for a vaccine against the disease. And, some of the nation's best medical scientists at places like Johns Hopkins or Yale or the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research were looking for a vaccine against, this feared crippler of America's children. So in the 1930s, there were actually a couple of vaccine candidates. They were developed by men who worked for the New York City Health Department, and, they tried to apply the vaccine. Unfortunately, the vaccine that they developed actually was responsible for giving children polio, and that negative outcome really had a chilling effect on vaccine research for about two decades. Now, as your listeners probably know, one of the most famous sufferers from polio was President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And to confront the disease, you know, in the 1930s, they began, you know, the president's birthday balls to raise money to find a cure or to find a preventive, to find a vaccine for polio. And that, in the 1940s, morphed into the National Foundation for the March of for Infantile Paralysis. And it included, you know, mothers raising money through the march, you know, people sending in their dimes, because this was a time when, you know, you didn't look to the federal government for money to do medical research. This was a, you know, a private kind of democratic effort to raise money. And, you know, the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis funded a great deal of important, significant medical research, including a vaccine candidate developed by the University of Pittsburgh researcher Jonas Salk. And in 1954, they undertook what was the largest experiment, I think, in the history of medicine. I don't know of any others like it. 1.8 million American children, ages 6 through 7, participated in a field trial of the Salk vaccine. It was conducted over a year. Children's parents, you know, signed a form for their children to participate. They knew that their child might either receive the vaccine or a placebo. And fortunately, in April 1955, they announced, you know, they had an effective vaccine against this terrible disease.
Right. And it was, and the way you were inoculated was different than, there was a sugar cube with the vaccine on it, right?
Well, that was actually a little bit later.
Oh.
So initially, these were inoculations. They were with a needle. Children, they used a needle on these children. And in 1955, you know, the federal government then, I mean, there was a rush. I mean, people celebrated. Jonas Salk becomes a national hero. He's everywhere. And, you know, people told him his life would never be the same. And America's, you know, five American pharmaceutical companies rushed in to produce the vaccine, you know, with as much speed as and urgency possible. But very shortly thereafter, it turned out that one of the laboratories, Cutter Laboratory in Berkeley, California, they found out they had produced 120,000 doses of the vaccine, but thousands of children became sick with polio, and at least five of them died, and polio vaccination stopped. Now, it turned out, you know, it was in the rush to move from the laboratory bench, you know, to sending it out the doors. Like, we've been seeing these marvelous photographs, you know, of freezers and stockpiles of vaccine being spread out across the nation. But the step from, you know, the laboratory bench to scaling it up, you know, 120,000 doses is a lot of vaccine. That had introduced, there was insufficient oversight of the process, and it turned out that the vaccine actually contained live, dangerous poliovirus.
Mm-hmm.
And so one outcome of that is that the federal government adopted really stringent rules to ensure the safety of vaccine. That included, you know, filtering it, storing it at the right temperatures, and safety testing. And, you know, today I think we are all beneficiaries of the fact that the, you know, that there is rigorous federal oversight of the safety of the vaccine. And so, again, this takes time. And so one of the things that's so remarkable about today, this very day, I guess it's getting to Iowa City. I think yesterday I know somebody got vaccinated against COVID here in Madison.
Yeah.
I mean, it is an this is really one for the books. Of course, the pandemic is one for the books. But,
yeah.
I mean, this will, I think, you know, it will be like the availability of penicillin in 20th century America. The idea that you could have an effective vaccine against this terrible disease in such a, you know, a staggeringly short time.
Will that be the historical marker that this week is remembered for, this period 2020 is remembered for, the speed at which a safe vaccine was created, far outpacing the development of other vaccines in history?
Right. Well, I think, to me as a historian of medicine, what's also extraordinary is how effective it is. I mean, at first I thought it was a mistake when I read it was 94% effective or 95% effective. You know, I think many of the people were hoping for at least 50% effective efficacy, you know, as a vaccine. Again, what's extraordinary is not only did they use sort of a new unprecedented technology of messenger RNA, but that they created an extraordinarily effective vaccine.
Not just one, but it seems like several. We have a whole menu of them here in a few months.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. And I have to say, again, I was a skeptic about anything called Operation Warp Speed, in part because it's named after something in Star Trek, which is, you know, not real. But the fact that you don't want to sacrifice safety to speed.
Yeah.
But again, it turns out that, you know, I mean, it's really unprecedented in the history of medicine.
Let me remind our listeners who may have just joined us, Sue Lederer is with us. She's at the University of Wisconsin at Madison in the School of Medicine and Public Health, a professor of the history of medicine and bioethics. A couple of other points I wanted to make sure to get to with you before our time ends here in less than 10 minutes. Tell us a little bit about the history of mandating vaccines. This vaccination drive is... There's a campaign out, hundreds of millions of dollars being spent to convince people to get this vaccination. But some vaccinations are mandated. What's the history of that?
Well, I think again, I'll have to go back to smallpox, because even though we had an effective vaccine against smallpox as early as the 1796, smallpox remained, you know, a source of concern in the United States well into the 20th century. There were outbreaks. And so as a condition of school attendance, for example, some vaccines the smallpox vaccine was mandated. And there was considerable resistance to the requirement that people undergo, or that children undergo, vaccination against smallpox in order to attend school. Or similarly, if you have an outbreak of smallpox in your city, there were some city health departments that mandated smallpox vaccination. And again, some people felt that that was an un-American intrusion on their personal liberty. Mm-hmm. And so it was brought to the state Supreme Court in the state of Massachusetts, and that decision ultimately went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And it was decided in 1905 in the case of Jacobson versus the state of Massachusetts that in the interests of public health, the state, you know, in this case Massachusetts, had the right to require its citizens to undergo, you know, state-sanctioned vaccination against smallpox in order to protect the larger interests of the health of the city and of the Commonwealth.
You're reminding me. Yeah, go ahead, Sue.
I was just going to say, I think it might be useful for your listeners to know that as soon as there was a vaccine, there was resistance to vaccination.
Okay. So you're reminding me, of course, in this time of masks and mask wearing being heavily politicized. To the degree that it's been politicized, are there any parallels to this in history away from vaccinations?
Well, I guess the one thing that comes to mind also comes from the 1790s. It relates to the terrible outbreak of yellow fever in the city of Philadelphia. You know, and at the time, Philadelphia was the national capital, and the disease became politicized between Federalists and Whigs, And primarily it was whether the disease originated in the United States or whether it came from elsewhere. And it became so politicized that, you know, if you believed that it originated in the United States, you tended to believe that the treatment was a very vigorous, robust, heroic treatment of bloodletting and cathartics. And if you believed it came from elsewhere, you believed that the appropriate treatment was supportive, no amazing amounts of blood being released from the body, but you gave people wine cordials and you tried to support them through the fever. So that's the only, and so this was a treatment that people were willing to die for, kind of thing. And also, if you believed it came from elsewhere, you were more likely to flee the city, in an effort to protect yourself. And it really divided the federal government. And some people think that's part of the reason that they removed, the capital from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C.
Interesting. I wonder, with your view as a medical historian, if you have some thoughts on how the current U.S. medical healthcare system, the public health policy that we have here, actually 50 in 50 different states in the case of this pandemic, how that will go down in history in the face of this incredible health crisis. Are there any profiles you can pick out there of how that will be remembered, especially, I suppose, when you compare our system with the health policy of other countries?
Well, I think, there are books to be written about that. We have, again, as you point out, 50 different state health departments. And, we do have a U.S. Public Health Service, and we do have a Surgeon General of the Public Health Service, and there are times when that has been a more influential, position than it has in some, in other administrations. And this is, I don't have anything to say against our current Surgeon General of the Public Health Service. But, there are certainly times when state health departments and states, people in various states, were more willing to listen to a national direction. But I'm afraid that the history of American public health is also, a history of tension between how states regard outbreaks in their own state and what steps they want to take to control it and federal jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And that's why for a long time, a number of people resisted having actually a cabinet-level secretaryship on health and human services. Mm-hmm. That had been debated much earlier, certainly around the turn of the 20th century. But we live in a country in which the ability of states to govern, their own outcomes is very much valued and protected.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if we can do this in the final minute, but ethics is also an area you focus on. Very quickly, your thoughts on the ethics surrounding the development of these vaccines.
Well, one of the things that I did follow was, again, this issue that I mentioned with James Phipps of challenge experiments. And I thought it was very interesting that in Britain, they were willing to allow volunteers to be challenged, to have their, their vaccination challenged by an injection of COVID-19 virus. But here in the United States, bioethicists, for the most part, did not support this, given that we have no effective treatment against the disease, no sure cure, for example. And so I do find that that's one very interesting bioethics question. And then just very briefly, there's also the question about how do you ensure protection for special populations, children,
mm-hmm.
for example, where, and only now, you start with adults, yeah. but you also need to establish the safety for children.
Right.
And, then there's the question of pregnant women.
Yes.
How do you ensure the safety of pregnant women and also, promote the welfare of their fetuses?
fascinating
times. Those are big questions.
Yes, fascinating times we live in, and fascinating to hear the historical context for the vaccination in this pandemic. Sue Lederer is the Robert Turrell Professor of the History of Medicine and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, the School of Medicine and Public Health there. Thank you so much, Sue. Fascinating work you're doing.
All right. Thank you so much.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Matt Alvarez, and Caitlin Harrop. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks so much for joining us.